You're listening to 90 Day Soulmate with the relationship engineers, Jim Golnick and Lisette Guevara, only on LA Talk Radio.
Psychology. There was about 300,000 years without a therapist. Well, we want to say welcome, everyone. I don't want to begin with psychology, but I just did. In fact, I don't even want to begin with civilization. I want to begin long before cities, you know, before anything was civilized, when we were wandering through the jungle where we were living in caves, long before governments. Long before schools, long before organization like that, long before hospitals, and long before anyone laid eyes on a psychiatrist's office that they've ever laid on a couch talking about their childhood. For nearly 300,000 years, modern humans survived without psychologists, without psychiatrists, without therapists, without antidepressants, without anxiety medication, without self-help books or social media. Influencers weren't around to tell them how to live. How did they ever survive, right? But somehow they did. They survived and they thrived. At least that's what we'd like to think, right? They fell in love, or they just dragged somebody into a cave with them, and that's how they spent the rest of their life together. But let's assume they fell in love. They raised children. They lost loved ones. They performed ceremonies and rituals in order to honor their loved ones. They experienced fear. They experienced grief. They, of course, had loneliness. They had times of uncertainty, and they experienced failure, and probably quite often. Everything we experience today, they experienced as well. So here's our first question tonight. What changed? Did anything change? Because the human brain hasn't changed very much in the last few thousand years. In fact, as scientists learn more and more, I believe they found the human brain hasn't changed very much in tens of thousands of years. The environment has changed dramatically. But let's look at this. Imagine waking up 20,000 years ago. The first question wasn't, how am I feeling today? The first question was, I'm a little bit hungry. What can I eat today, right? Fear wasn't considered a disorder. Fear kept you alive. Anxiety wasn't a disease. It reminded us and you that something dangerous might be nearby. It kept us on edge, making sure that we stayed safe. Loneliness wasn't necessarily a problem. It encouraged you to return to the tribe, to be part of the community, to basically you base your survival on those around you. Because if you were alone, you usually died. Think about that. Today, many people say, yeah, I just want everyone to leave me alone. I just want to be by myself. I don't want to talk, right? That they just want to be alone. But 20,000 years ago, being left alone was often a death sentence. Our emotions weren't random. The things that are innate to us aren't random either, right? They served a purpose. Almost always, emotions developed over thousands and millions of years to help us survive. That was serving a purpose. Nature doesn't usually waste energy. They don't create systems. It doesn't create systems without a function. Pain has a purpose. We want to avoid it. Hunger has a purpose. We want to feed ourselves. Thirst has a purpose, right? It's a purposeful thirst. We need something to drink or we'll die. Fear has a purpose. So here's the first thought I'd like you to consider. What if many emotions involved and involved and involved in us. But what if the emotions evolved not to make us happy, but to keep us alive? That is very different than the way we look at psychology today. Now, here's another question. How did people cope? You know, no therapist, no medication, no diagnosis. Yeah, what can you do without somebody telling you what to do? The answer is surprisingly simple. They had purpose. Every day mattered. Every relationship mattered. Everything they did in their environment mattered for their survival. You could say they were under stress, but you could say they didn't really think that they were under stress. That was normal. They hunted. They built shelters. They gathered food. They protected children. They learned skills. They learned new skills that were necessary to survive. They contributed to the tribe. There wasn't much time to sit around and go, I wonder how I feel. I wonder if life has meaning. Life demanded meaning. It meant to be alive. What did life mean? I'm alive. Contribution, right? Contribution to your tribe created the identity, your identity. Competence created confidence. We discussed this before. Belonging created security. It wasn't being different. It was fitting in and getting along with others. Failure had immediate consequences, but success did too. Now, let's compare that with today. Many of us spend our days inside of buildings, right? Looking at glowing rectangles, the computers on our desks. Answering emails. What the heck are those? All we used to do in the past was hand somebody a leaf with something scribbled on it, like, here's where the buffalo are. Attend virtual meetings. Driving in traffic. That seems really normal and natural, doesn't it? And we wonder why we're exhausted. Maybe it's not because we are broken. And that's actually really the thought behind today's whole show. It's not that we are broken. Maybe it's because our environment has changed faster than our biology. Hold on to that thought, because by the end of tonight's show, we're going to ask a question that engineers ask every day. When something doesn't work, do we redesign the person, or do you redesign the system? Is it the person or the system? Engineers precisely think it's the system.
Once upon a time, there was a couple and a newborn baby. Or should I say, a single mum. This brave young lady left her 9-to-5 job to follow her passion and started a consulting business. Her friends helped out. She travelled the world, met new people, and again came home. The woman dated to find a man who would fill her life and fit her plan. She met a guy who checked out ladies. That burned her up. That made her crazy. Other guys were full of verve. Into their self, no room for her. And one time she met a man with patch over eye and axe in hand. Then one day she had enough. Her little boy was all grown up, tired of attracting the wrong type of guy. It was time to give something else a try. She got her computer and started to plan and created a process to find her man. Soon she went on a perfect date. And then she knew it must be fate. In just 90 days, that is all it took. How she found her match? It is in the book.
Victoria experiences the past, present, and future while sleeping. Will she be able to decipher the mystery of the symbols, messages, and images of her dreams before it is too late? Discover the lives she lives while Victoria dreams.
Welcome back to 90 Day Soulmate. Segment 2. Civilization. Different minds built great societies. So we all weren't the same mind. We were different. Now something remarkable has happened. About 10 to 12,000 years ago, humans stopped wandering. Agriculture changed everything, right? Instead of moving with the seasons to different areas, we built villages. Villages became towns. Towns became cities. Civilization was born. And the civilization had a completely different problem than survival. Specialization. Not everyone needed to hunt anymore. Somebody could become a blacksmith. Somebody could become the builder. Somebody could become the teacher. Someone could become the merchant. Probably there are lots of merchants, right? Selling things back and forth. Someone could become the physician or the doctor or the herbalist, right? Somebody could become the storyteller. Something fascinating happened. The very differences that might have made someone unusual in a small tribe suddenly became very valuable for the civilization. This brings us to one of psychology's most interesting thinkers, Carl Jung, or Jung, depending on how you pronounce his last name. I say Carl Jung. Many people know Jung for dreams or the collective unconscious, where societies around the world had these same underlying pinned archetypes. I think one of his most practical ideas was something called archetypes, right? So Jung noticed that throughout history, certain personality patterns kept appearing, not because people copied one another, but because societies repeatedly needed certain kinds of people, and these naturally developed. Think of these as less as personality labels and more as civilization's jobs. You know, the job descriptions of the people in the civilization, right? So every civilization needs heroes, people who are willing to run towards the danger to save the day while everyone else runs away. People such as soldiers, firefighters, rescuers. Every civilization needs sages, those who study, those who are the teachers. They're the scientists, the philosophers, the thinkers. People who preserve and pass on knowledge, knowledge of how to do things, raising the level of education of those that are in that civilization. Every civilization needs creators, architects, engineers, inventors, artists, people who imagine something and then make it come into reality, things that don't yet exist. They take out of their mind, put on paper, and then build. Every civilization needs people who give care, the caregivers, parents, nurses, neighbors, the people who hold families and communities together. Every civilization needs explorers, right? Those people who are willing to sail beyond the horizon. We idolize in some cultures. Christopher Columbus, he's all over the globe as like, oh, he came from Spain, he came from Italy, he came from Portugal. These are the people who are willing to go to some place that doesn't exist. It's almost like Star Trek. They start companies, they take risks, they expand what is possible. Every civilization needs rebels, those who kind of push back, those who have an opposing view, not those who destroy everything, but people who are willing to challenge the broken systems. Many of history's greatest advances began with someone saying, there's got to be a better way. Every civilization even needs jesters. That may sound funny, but humor reduces tension. Stories in that humor help preserve the culture. Laughter builds connection. Sometimes the court jester was the only person who could safely tell the king the truth. Those clothes maybe not be the best thing for you because I can see right through them. Think about that. Now, here's the question. If civilization depends upon different kinds of minds, why are we sometimes so uncomfortable with people who think differently? Is every difference a defect? Or have some differences always been a source of innovation? As an engineer, I've learned something. I've learned that everyone on the design team doesn't agree. And if they do agree, we're probably not thinking very hard. We don't get creative. We don't come up with a new solution. Innovation almost always comes from someone who sees the world differently. Now, we're going to connect to our first segment through all this. So for hundreds of thousands of years, success meant fitting into the tribe, being like everyone else, getting along with everyone else, working with everyone else. Then civilization arrived, and we celebrated the differences. Suddenly, success also required people who stood apart from the tribe, had differences. Different minds became civilization's greatest competitive advantage, which raises another fascinating question. At what point does valuable diversity become diagnosable diversity? That question didn't exist in prehistoric times. It barely existed in ancient civilizations. But over the next century, psychology would begin trying to answer it. It all started with one man. Actually, there's probably lots around the globe, but we're going to focus on one. It started with one man who asked the question no one had ever asked before. What if the real cause of all human behavior are hidden beneath our conscious awareness, right? Unconsciously, these are the motivational factors for our behavior. This man was Sigmund Freud, which we probably all know, and that's where we'll go next. So we'll begin connecting psychology to its history instead of just presenting famous names. This section explains why Freud mattered and why psychology took the path it did. In segment 3, we're going to talk about Freud, the first great interpreter of the human mind. Let's imagine it's about 1900, the year 1900. You're having emotional problems. You can't sleep. You feel anxious. Your relationships are falling apart. You can't concentrate. What does your doctor have to offer? No antidepressants, no anti-anxiety medications, no ADHD medications, no mood stabilizers, no brain scans, no MRI, no CAT scans, no PET scans. Psychology had almost no tools at the time. Then comes along Sigmund Freud. Whether you love Freud or hate him, it's difficult to overstate his impact. He didn't simply change psychology. He changed the way Western civilization thought about itself. Freud asked some interesting questions. Freud asked one revolutionary question. What if much of our behavior is driven by forces we don't even realize are there? That sounds kind of obvious today, but back in 1900, that was revolutionary. Freud believed the mind was like an iceberg. Only a little bit of it was conscious, and the rest of it fell below the conscious ability to understand what was going on. So the small portion above the water represented the conscious thought that we have, that we think, what we're thinking about. But below the surface, hidden from view, was a much larger unconscious mind. He proposed that childhood experiences, hidden fears, internal conflicts, and unconscious desires quietly influenced all adult behavior. Behavior of adults were completely controlled, or mostly controlled, by all these underconscious level thoughts. Whether every detail of Freud's theory was scientific is beside the point. His greatest contribution was changing the question and the way we thought about it. Before Freud, psychology asked, what do people do? Freud asked, why do people do it? That changed everything. He also introduced psychoanalysis. Today, that word is very often misunderstood. People picture someone lying on a couch talking endlessly about their parents. But think about the world Freud lived in. If you have no medications, conversations become your medicine. Talking wasn't simply gathering information. Talking was the treatment. The therapist became an investigator, you know, like Columbo, a detective, somebody trying to connect events from childhood, relationships, even your dreams, and recurring patterns that occurred in your life. He would try to fit into a story that made sense. In many ways, Freud believed that understanding yourself could reduce your suffering. Basically, it's almost self-analysis, but you're talking with somebody that helps you through, a facilitator. It's a fascinating idea because it assumes that insight itself has healing power. Your own observation of yourself and understanding can heal. Now, here's where I'd like you to think like an engineer. Suppose your car makes a strange noise. One mechanic says, I know why it's making that noise. another mechanic actually fixes the engine. These are two different accomplishments. Understanding and solving aren't always the same thing. That doesn't make understanding unimportant. It simply reminds us that explanation and resolution are two different goals. Psychology, at least initially, leaned heavily towards explanation, why people behave the way they behave. Perhaps that made sense. It yet didn't have tools in its tool chest to address those things, but psychology wouldn't stay there for long. A new generation of psychologists arrived and said, hey, wait a minute. How do we know Freud is right? In fact, a lot of people disagree with Freud. How do we actually measure any of this? If two psychologists interpret the same patient differently, who's correct? I like to say, if you have two psychologists, you have three opinions. Psychology wanted to become a science. Science demands measurement. That brings us to two men who fundamentally changed the direction of psychology. John Watson, and then later, B.F. Skinner. And that is not Sherlock Holmes and John Watson. That's John Watson and B.F. Skinner. So let's get into segment four. We're going to talk about Watson and Skinner. Can human behavior be engineered? To me, this is exciting because I got into psychology through engineering. So let's see how the two fit. Imagine watching a child learn to ride a bicycle. You don't know what's happening inside the child's mind. You can see his thoughts. You can't actually see his thoughts, right? You can't measure feelings, but you can observe how pedals, falls, gets up again, tries again. Eventually, the child succeeds. That observation became the foundation of behaviorism. In the early 1900s, John B. Watson challenged much of psychology. His argument was remarkably simple. You can't observe it objectively. If you can't, right? If you can't observe it objectively, you can't study it scientifically. Thoughts, invisible. Dreams, invisible. The unconscious, invisible. Behavior, observable. You need to be able to observe it in order to make sense of it. Behavior is observable, measurable, repeatable. Watson wanted psychology to become as rigorous as physics or chemistry. Make it a science. Instead of interpreting hidden motives, he focused on what people actually did, their behaviors. His famous little Albert experiment, though ethically unacceptable by today's standards, demonstrated that fear responses could be conditioned rather than simply inherited. That idea transformed psychology. Behavior wasn't just something people had. Behavior could be learned. And if it could be learned, perhaps it could be changed. Now, we have B.F. Skinner steps in. He took Watson's ideas one step further. He asked, if behavior can be learned, can it be also systematically shaped? His answer to that question became known as operant conditioning. The principle is one of most parents, obviously, right? Parents discover this naturally. Behaviors followed by rewarding consequences tend to increase. So you reward a behavior, the behavior increases. Behaviors followed by unpleasant consequences or by no reward tend to decrease. It sounds simple, but think about how many areas of life it influences. Schools, grades, good grades reward studying. I guess bad grades don't, right? Business bonuses reward performance. With parents, praise reinforces desirable behavior. For governments, taxes and fines influence decisions. Also, right, rules and regulations. Casinos, variable rewards keep people playing. Social media, likes, click, click, click. Endorphins get dropped into our brain, right? And comments, notifications, infinite scrolling reward behavior. The smartphone in your pocket may be one of the most sophisticated operant conditioning devices ever created. Every notification is a tiny, unpredictable reward for being attached to it. Exactly the type of reinforcement schedule that Skinner found could be especially powerful in maintaining behavior. Think about that. Psychology didn't just become a science. It became a science that could influence behavior on an enormous scale. Now, here's the connection to the rest of our story. Freud wanted to understand the individual. Watson wanted to predict behavior. Skinner wanted to shape behavior. These are three different goals, three different philosophies, three different versions of psychology. But none of them ask what I think may be the biggest question of all. What if the person isn't the primary problem? What if the environment is? As an engineer, that's where my mind naturally goes. If thousands of competent people struggle under the same conditions, perhaps we should spend less time asking, hey, what's wrong with these people? How do we fix these people? And maybe we should be asking, what's wrong with the system? What's wrong with modern environment? It takes us into something which we call, or I call, environmental psychology, organizational behavior, and ultimately to something I've spent much of my career studying. It's actually industrial organizational behavior, psychology within that. How environments quietly shape thoughts, emotions, decisions, and behavior, often before we're even aware they're doing it. The environment pushes us into feeling certain ways and taking on certain behaviors.
Tired of attracting the wrong type of guy, it was time to give something else a try. She got her computer and started to plan and created a process to find her man. Soon she went on a perfect date. And then she knew it must be fate. In just 90 days, that is all it took. How she found her match? It is in the book.
Victoria experiences the past, present, and future while sleeping. Will she be able to decipher the mystery of the symbols, messages, and images of her dreams before it is too late? Discover the lives she lives while Victoria dreams.
Segment 5. We changed the world faster than we changed ourselves. I'd like you to ask yourself to imagine two engineers. The first engineer designs airplanes. Thousands of pilots began making mistakes with the planes. The engineer concludes, we need better pilots. The second engineer asks, maybe we need a better cockpit. It's the same problem, completely different solutions, right? Engineers are trained to ask one question before blaming the user. Could the system be better designed? That question rarely gets asked in psychology. Psychology often begins with the individual. Engineers often begin with the environment. Now think about the environment that the humans evolved in. Humans evolved in for almost 300,000 years. They had this environment where they walked every day. 5 to 10 miles wasn't unusual. They had no Fitbit. They had no Apple Watch tracking them. They just did it. They climbed. They lifted. We built. We hunted. We gathered. We did things that kept us physically active. We slept when it became dark. We woke with the sunrise. We were constantly engaged with our environment. Our senses were constantly listening to birds, to the wind, to the trees, feeling water, changing terrain as we climbed, feeling the ground under our feet, understanding distance, having movement. Our bodies, our eyes, our ears, our muscles, our balance were constantly challenged. They received meaningful information almost all day long. Now let's compare that with today. We wake up to an alarm. Artificial light comes through the little lamps in our room. We have coffee to wake us up. Then we have to deal with traffic on the way to work. We get to the office, get to a cubicle, turn on our computer, the little glowing box. We have our phone, the meetings, email, notifications, lunch at our desk. We need to get more work done. We have more screens that we look at. We have more artificial lighting. We have LED and we have incandescent and we have fluorescent. Our climate-controlled buildings, we don't get to feel nature. Then we go home and we have another screen. The average office worker may spend over 90% of the day indoors. That's an extraordinary change in evolutionary terms. And then we ask, why are people stressed? Why are they distracted? Why do they report being anxious? Maybe the better question is, would our ancestors have recognized this as living? Now, I'd like to share something that grew out of my graduate work in organizational psychology. One of the biggest mistakes organizations make is assuming people respond only to policies, procedures, and management. They don't. They respond to the environments that they find themselves in. Before you consciously think, your sensors are already working. In my research, I expanded the traditional five senses into what I call the 7 TM framework. Most people know about vision and hearing and touch and smell and taste, but there are other sensory systems that constantly shape our experience, especially when we're out in the real world walking around. The vestibular system, which gives us balance, movement, and spatial orientation, that's always in play when we're out and about in the wilderness. And pre-conception, or it's actually proprioception, it's the awareness of where our body exists in space. So we know where we are, getting around a tree, finding ourselves, fitting into small nooks and crannies. These systems are working every day and every second of the day without asking permission, long before conscious thought begins. Now imagine you're in an office, no windows, fluorescent lights, gray walls, no plants, constant noise, no privacy, no movement, no natural light. Compare that with another office. Glass, trees, natural daylight, quiet spaces, open collaboration, wood, water, comfortable walking paths, places to think, places to interact with others. Do these two environments produce the same thoughts? Of course not. The environment quietly shapes the experience. In my paper that I wrote, I use a sports arena analogy. Think about a football stadium. There are lines on the field. The players wear uniforms. There are goalposts at both ends of the field. There are referees, the crowd, the sidelines. Everything tells you how to behave. This is the field in which you play. This is where you get a first down. This is the goal to where you're going. All these things indicate a certain behavior. Nobody has to explain where the quarterback stands. He knows because it's part of his position. It's put into the playbook. The environment already did that. Workplaces are exactly the same way. If they use architecture, lighting, layout, sound, transparency, movement correctly, they all can quietly communicate expectations before anyone says a single word. Now, here's the question I want you to think about. If the environment shapes behavior, why do we spend so much time trying to redesign people instead of redesigning environments? Hold on to that thought, because psychology eventually created something intended to organize every known psychological condition. It became the most influential book in modern medicine, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, better known as the DSM. What's the DSM, you ask? The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. It's used in psychology in order to define, generally speaking, disorders across the board, so everyone has the same book that they can read from. So when the human experience became classified in this book, let's make an analogy. Imagine you and I are bird watchers. We publish a book. The first edition contains 106 books. 106 books. The first edition contains 106 birds. But 20 years later, now we found more birds. There's 182. Later, there are 265 birds. Eventually, 300 birds. Did nature suddenly create hundreds of new birds, or did we become better at recognizing and classifying birds as different things? That's one way to understand the history of psychology's most influential reference book. The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, or the DSM. The DSM wasn't created to label people. Its original purpose was actually quite practical. Psychiatrists needed a common language. If one doctor diagnosed schizophrenia, another doctor should recognize the same condition. Insurance companies then needed diagnostic codes. Researchers needed consistent definitions. Hospitals needed standardized records. The first edition of DSM, which was DSM-1, was published in 1952. It had 106 disorders in about 130 pages. Psychology was still relatively young, and then came the DSM number 2 in 1968. The number of recognized diseases increased, or should I say disorders increased. But the biggest change came in 1980, DSM-3. Many psychologists consider this the single biggest transformation in modern psychiatry. Why? Because psychiatry moved away from broad psychoanalytic interpretations toward detailed diagnostic criteria. Symptoms became checklists. If enough boxes were checked, a diagnosis could be made. The goal was consistency, and in many ways it succeeded. Different clinicians became more likely to reach similar diagnoses. Research became easier. Insurance reimbursement became easier. Clinical trials became easier, but something else happened. The manual continued growing. Now along comes DSM-4, nearly 300 recognized disorders. Then DSM-5, reorganized, expanded, updated. Today the manual approaches 1,000 pages. So let's stop for a moment. I'm not suggesting that's good. I'm not suggesting that's bad. I'm asking a systems question. As our ability to classify human behavior increases, what naturally happens? More research, more specialists, more awareness, and more educational programs, more screening, more insurance codes, more treatment options. None of that requires bad intentions anywhere, right? It's simply what happens when knowledge expands. But here's the question I don't hear asked very often. As our ability to classify people increases, does our definition of normal become broader or narrower? Think about that. Every time we create a new category, we also create a new boundary between normal variation and diagnosable variation. Sometimes that's unquestionably beneficial. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes it helps people who were previously ignored, but also raises another question. If every profession naturally grows, what happens when psychology itself becomes much larger and much larger of an economic ecosystem? That's where we're headed next. Because understanding the mind eventually became much more than just science. It became industry. And that's where I want to introduce something I call the evolution of monetization model.
Once upon a time, there was a couple and a newborn baby. Or should I say, a single mum. This brave young lady left her 9-to-5 job to follow her passion and started a consulting business. Her friends helped out. She traveled the world, met new people, and again came home. The woman dated, to find a man who would fill her life and fit her plan. She met a guy who checked out ladies. That burned her up. That made her crazy. Other guys were full of verve. Into their self, no room for her. And one time she met a man with patch over eye and axe in hand. Then one day she had enough. Her little boy was all grown up, tired of attracting the wrong type of guy. It was time to give something else a try. She got her computer and started to plan and created a process to find her man. Soon she went on a perfect date, and then she knew it must be fate. In just 90 days, that is all it took. How she found her match? It is in the book.
Victoria experiences the past, present, and future while sleeping. Will she be able to decipher the mystery of the symbols, messages, and images of her dreams before it is too late? Discover the lives she lives while Victoria dreams.
Welcome back. Let's talk about the evolution of the monetization model. Throughout tonight's show, we've watched psychology evolve. First, people simply survived, then civilization rewarded specialization. Freud wanted to understand the mind, Watson wanted to observe behavior, Skinner wanted to shape behavior, the DSM wanted to classify behavior. Notice something. Each step kind of made perfect sense. Each step solved a real problem, but something else happened along the way. Every successful profession naturally grows. Think about dentistry. Originally, pull a tooth. Today, cleaning, orthodontics, cosmetic dentistry, implants. Oh, I go to my dentist and they start talking to me about sleep apnea, mouth guards, veneers. Now we've got specialists for children, specialists for surgery. The profession expanded, not because dentists are evil, but because knowledge expanded. The same thing happens in engineering. Electrical engineering became power, electronics, communications, computer engineering, microelectronics, robotics, artificial intelligence. Every profession expands as it learns more. Let's ask the same question about psychology. Originally, psychology generated knowledge. Today, psychology exists inside an enormous ecosystem. There are universities, there are researchers, there are professional licensing, therapists, psychologists, psychiatrists, insurance companies. Of course, there are pharmaceutical companies. There's telehealth companies, mental health apps for your phone, assessment companies, corporate wellness programs, employee assistant programs, hello, government agencies, continuing education, social media influencers who talk about psychology, book publishers, life coaches, mental health podcasts. Everyone occupies a different role. Everyone believes they're helping. Most are. But every system also develops incentives. Insurance companies need diagnostic codes. Universities need students. Researchers need funding. Drug companies need successful products. Therapists need clients. Apps need subscribers. Professional organizations need members. Again, that doesn't imply corruption, but there's a need to fill. It simply means incentives exist. As an engineer, I always ask one question. What behavior does the system reward? Well, sounds like operant conditioning. Systems always move in the direction of their incentives. That's true in business, that's true in government, that's true in education. Why wouldn't it be true in healthcare? Let me introduce something I've been thinking about. It's called the evolution of the monetization model. That it's a monetization model that's evolved over time, right? The idea is simple. As knowledge grows, markets often grow with it. So the market grows as the knowledge grows. Understanding becomes expertise. Expertise becomes specialization. Specialization becomes professional practice. Professional practice becomes reimbursement for all the knowledge I have. Reimbursement becomes an industry. The important point isn't whether that's good or bad. It's just that it is. It's that every mature profession develops its own economic ecosystem. The interesting question is this: when does the economic ecosystem begin influencing the way problems themselves are defined? That isn't unique to psychology. It happens in every profession. And that's why EMM isn't just about psychology. It's a framework for understanding how incentives quietly shape the evolution of entire industries. Now, let's ask the hardest question of the evening. If someone says, "I feel better," what does that exactly mean? So we're going to talk about that in segment 8 and the final segment of this show. What are we actually measuring when someone says, "I feel better"? And what if we've been solving the wrong problem? Suppose two people come into my office. Both are anxious. Both can't sleep. Both are overwhelmed. Person number one receives medication. 6 weeks later, they report, "Hey, I feel much better." Person number two quits a toxic job, starts walking every morning, sleeps 8 hours a day, reconnects with family and friends, spends less time on social media, finds meaningful work, and 6 weeks later, they also report, "I feel much better." Here's my question. What improved? The answer isn't necessarily the same. In one case, the chemistry changed. In the other case, the environment changed. Maybe both were appropriate. Maybe both were necessary, but they're not the same intervention. As an engineer, I keep coming back to one simple question. Imagine the warning light comes on in your car. There are two ways to make the warning light disappear. And I remember this as a joke from years ago. One is repair the engine, and two is disconnect the warning light. If the light is out either way, it seems like it's no longer a problem, but only one fixes the underlying problem. Now, let's be really clear on this. I'm not comparing medication to disconnecting a warning light. Sometimes medication is life-saving. Sometimes it allows someone to function well enough to rebuild their life. There are severe psychiatric illnesses where medication has transformed lives. No serious discussion should ignore that. But I do wonder whether we've become increasingly comfortable asking people to adapt to environments that may themselves be unhealthy. And maybe we should ask a different question. Instead of asking, "What's wrong with this student? What's wrong with this patient?" Maybe we should ask, "Is this school designed for the way children naturally learn?" Instead of asking, "Why can't this employee concentrate?" should we ask, "Is this workplace helping people succeed or constantly overwhelming them in how it's set up?" Instead of asking, "Why are so many teenagers anxious?" should we ask, "What kind of digital environments have we built for them? And why are they dangerous?" For most of my engineering career, whenever we had a quality problem, we were taught something very important. Don't blame the operator until you've examined the process. Sometimes the operator made the mistake. Sometimes the process almost guaranteed that that mistake would be made. Psychology has spent more than a century becoming remarkably good at understanding individuals. Maybe the next great breakthrough won't come from understanding individuals better. Maybe it will come from understanding environments better. Maybe we'll discover that many struggles we've been trying to solve inside people's heads actually begin outside them. perhaps the next chapter in psychology is this. It's not simply asking, how do we help people adapt to the world, but asking, how do we build a world that better fits the people who must live in it? That may be the most important psychological question of the next 100 years. Thank you for joining us on 90 Day Soulmate. And until next week, keep asking better questions, because better questions almost always lead to better answers. Have a great week.
You're listening to 90 Day Soulmate with the Relationship Engineers, Jim Golnick and Lisette Guevara, only on LA Talk Radio.